are Vineyard.
Somos Viña.
We are Vineyard.
Most of us come to our calling through pain. I think there is some kind of a beautiful, reciprocal and redemptive interrelationship between our wound, our pain, our failure, and our destiny and what God had, the work that God has for us to do. Yeah. And it's certainly true of my autobiography, my story. And I think, you know, I grew up in this very staunch, like, evangelical model of discipleship. And, you know, evangelicalism comes out of a kind of enlightenment, Cartesian worldview. It's very information-based. And there's this kind of formula for what we would have called spiritual growth at the time, or like old school sanctification. And it's essentially, you know, again, it was not in the charismatic stream, which picks this up and then adds some things to it. But it was essentially come to church on Sunday and learn more about the Bible, read the Bible, study the Bible, listen to preaching on the Bible, have a morning quiet time, and then tithe or give. And small groups were not even like in our radar. So there wasn't even a call to like do life in a living room, wasn't even on the formula that I grew up with. And again, all of those practices are in my rule of life. I continue them today. I'm not down on them. It was just missing a more holistic, ancient, frankly, more biblical view of discipleship.
Welcome to the We Are Vineyard podcast, conversations to help us grow with Jesus and each other. In today's episode, Jay Pathak talks to John Mark Comer, founder of Practicing the Way and Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon. John Mark is the author of a number of best-selling books and will be featured by video at our Vineyard USA national conferences this summer. Let's listen in.
Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in the Bay Area of California, what's now called Silicon Valley.
Wow. What did your folks do that you lived there?
My parents were first generation kind of followers of Jesus, came to faith in the Jesus movement at the end of it. My dad played in a rock band in the Bay Area professionally. They opened for Fleetwood Mac. They did the soundtrack for a movie. Things were going really well. Was not a Christian. And although, of course, it was a very different time, Christendom was still alive and well even there. But his ex-girlfriend invited him to a Billy Graham crusade, and he was not interested in Jesus, but he was interested in getting back together with his ex-girlfriend, who, to make the story awkward, is not my mother.
but hey, it worked.
But went
for her.
And
we're thankful for her.
He is not a Calvinist, but the way he tells the story, he found himself going forward at the end. And ended up, interesting, in one of the first megachurches in the country. So I was shocked when I read this because the widespread amount of megachurches right now. But in the 1970s, the stat is there are only 10 churches over 2,000 people in the entire continental U.S. So if that stat is true or something approximating I grew up in one of them. So he came to faith, ended up playing the drums there, became a worship pastor, eventually became a senior pastor, a church planter, all that stuff. So he was a pastor at a large church there in Los Gatos, and that's where I grew up.
Because to be in the Silicon Valley, you either have had to have made money or be in ministry, right? Pretty much?
Well, no, now, not then. No, I mean, the house, I drove by the house, you know, we do this like heritage tour with my boys when they came of age. We road trip down Highway 1, and I drove by with my dad the house that I grew up in. It's this little three-bedroom tiny little uncool track home, and like, and now it is worth like a fortune.
I
think he paid $30,000 for it, you know. So no, it was very just middle class kind of normative at the time. I mean, there were signs. I remember when BMWs, people started driving BMWs, and it was like, oh, the yuppie was a new term. I remember we pulled up next to Steve Wozniak's Porsche at 7-Eleven one day, and we're like, hey, this guy's starting this new company.
That's kind of cool.
But yeah, I'm dating myself a bit here. But no, it was very different. I mean, the cost of living now is astronomical.
Yeah, it's a whole different place. Okay, so you're raised in this mega church that you didn't know was a mega church.
Yeah.
And is that by and large a positive? Like, this is a good experience? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think I say that because I grew up very much inside like the heart of evangelicalism and the mega church movement. And yeah, I mean, I don't have angst about it. I'm really grateful for the foundation it laid in my life, the high view of scripture, the high view of obedience to Jesus, frankly, the role of daily kind of what we would have called a devotional life.
Right.
You know, people mock a quiet time, but I think it's one of the most precious gifts of that tradition.
Yeah.
So really grateful for that. But at this, and there was enough in it that was compelling that I eventually felt a desire to give my life to it and pastor and church plant. But at the same time, I'm also a product of the limitations of that movement and its model of discipleship and its ability to kind of bring a lot of people into the early stages of the spiritual journey. And then a lot of people tend to stall out and get stuck and kind of plateau.
Yeah.
And that was very much my experience. So yeah, I don't have angst. I'm grateful for the foundation, but that's definitely not the the water I swim in today.
Yeah, but that's good to know, because a lot of people who want to have the second conversation are mad about the first one. So like, it's good to hear you say, no, I'm grateful for that, but I think there's more that I've gotten experience and learned. Okay, so in all that, then are you thinking, I'm going to be a pastor? That's definitely what I'm going to do. I'm going to like do ministry. Or were you going to be a rock star?
Not early on. Yeah, I want to be a rock star.
Okay.
Early on, I remember at one point I was always following Jesus. So I never had that, you know, son of a pastor reactionary moment, not to downplay it, but that was just not my story.
Right.
But I wanted nothing to do with pastoring. I think one, I'm pretty introverted, and at least the model was an extroverted job. And two, I just saw my dad work really, really hard and make like no money.
Right.
I thought, I'll work hard, but I want to do well.
Yeah, I'd like to make some
money. And I remember literally saying to Jesus at one point, I'll do anything except be a pastor.
Mm.
But then had a, I would not have had language for it at the time. It was not a charismatic stream of the church, but was on retreat when I was 16 years old, I think 17 years old. And had an encounter with the Spirit of Jesus where I, you know, I would not have language for it, but I think God clearly spoke to my heart and asked me to do that thing that I said I would not do.
Right.
So from a pretty young age, that was the trajectory.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was a part of a church plant, actually with a vineyard person. So my dad was a pastor, and we moved up to a suburb of Portland, Oregon when I was in high school, because the pastor of our church had an affair, blew up his life, blew up the church, real sad story. Moved up to a different church, and I really was unhappy with it. It was a very shallow, very superficial kind of suburban church. I was not into it. I left the youth group in a zealous rage because it was so stupid and wasted my time, and which tells you more about me than it does about the youth group. And my dad went on staff for about 5 years when I was a junior in high school at a Christian nonprofit. So the first time ever, I had the freedom to go to a different church.
Go where you want, right.
And one of my mom's dear friend, they were part of the vineyard movement. They've been up in Seattle, the Seattle Vineyard, and they moved back to Portland. And she was a worship leader. And that was when, you know, or this would have been like 1996, 1997. Yeah. It's like the height of like some of the music coming at that time is just extraordinary. And so we went down to this little, wasn't a vineyard, but it was in that kind of stream.
Right.
It was a non-denominational thing, but this little church plant. And I went down with the couple, with the dad, and was a part. I'd never been in a small church, and I'd never been in a church plant in my life. I'd been in nothing but large established churches.
Yeah.
So it was my first experience, and that lit up my heart.
Really?
I was there every time the door was open.
Hi.
I joined everything you could possibly join.
What about it?
I just lived at that little church plant.
Because that's not normally the trajectory, right?
And that's what I wanted. I was
why?
I want to do this.
What about it?
I don't know. I mean, I love the relational nature.
Yeah.
Of, I think now in hindsight, I understand it better. I think it was my first experience of like an actual community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dunbar's principle, once a church gets over 150 people, the group psychology changes from a community to a crowd. And crowds serve important roles.
Right.
They're not bad, but they don't serve the role of community.
Right.
And so it was my first experience of 80 people doing life together, and church was like a day together, and I was known. And my first experience of being developed as a leader very intentionally, first experience of something at the time that felt culturally contextualized to the moment, you know? And something that was more relaxed, and you know what I mean? It was so, it was a beautiful moment in my life. I look back at that season with a lot of affection in my heart. And that's really where I felt this desire start to well up in my heart to plant a church and to do something different than what I've been a part of before.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So then from there, do you move quickly towards church planting or do you end up sort of on
Yeah, way too quickly. No, and I'm not joking. Yeah, I think it's actually in hindsight.
Right.
Don't do that.
Right.
Yeah. I had a really interesting conversation with a leadership coach, Jack Nicholson. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He does work with leaders. And we did this kind of pastor's forum with him. And he was inevitably asked the question about pastors blowing up their lives and why the, you know, explosion of that. And he gave an answer I had never heard anybody give before. And he might be wildly off, but I thought it was provocative. His theory was when pastors go into ministry too young, nobody in their early 20s has the spiritual maturity to pastor people yet, to really have that level of spiritual authority. So what we do is we all fake it.
You pretend.
Because we might have the ability to preach a sermon.
Right.
We might have the ability to organize a crowd. We might have the ability to gather people together.
Right.
But we're not yet a mother or a father. We're still us.
Yeah.
And so we learn to fake it. Mm-hmm. And then we end up, you know, in his frame, building a ministry off of our false self, off of our ego. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, if we either decide that we need to integrate to who we actually are and deal with our shadow and go below the line, whatever language you want to use. Now the problem is we built a whole ministry around a person that's not actually us, it's
that's
a projection
right.
of us.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did that and we started really young. I've been on staff at a church since I was 19 years old. And so I'm a product of that and by the grace of God have been able to stay the course, but yet a lot of like, oh man, you know, I wish. You know, I was listening to somebody the other day, older, very well-known pastor was asked, do you have any regrets? And he said, I have no regrets.
Whoa.
And I honestly, in my heart, I thought, I will never listen to you ever again in my life. I can't ever, how could I respect somebody?
Totally.
You're either unbelievable or in denial or something.
Yeah.
I have so many regrets.
Well, from today. I mean,
from this morning, much less the last 2 decades.
Yeah, it's like, wow, that's, what would that even be like? That's, that sounds terrifying. Okay, so.
You must have some really good therapists.
So it's like, wow. So, okay, so you start in too early. Of course, all this stuff starts to grow. You build
it. And God's kind. God uses
the shadow. Of course.
I mean, his extraordinary mercy.
But you build this incredible church, which people, I'm sure, probably know about. And in all of that, you're making all these different. You're just becoming aware of different kinds of things. So now you're doing, you know, the work you're doing now. So focused, caring about spiritual formation, development of the soul.
Yeah.
You're writing beautifully to that end. Talk about some of the main, what were some of the main moves? Like, what are the moments where you were like, wait a minute, either out of crisis, like, man, I got to figure something out for me, or out of just maybe learning or experiences. How did some of those from skyrocketing young evangelical pastors going to take over the world to spiritual formation, thinking about your soul, building communities and that. What were some of those moves like? What were those turns?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the story.
It winds.
Yes, it winds back and forth and forward and backward. But I think most of us come to our calling through pain. I think there is some kind of a beautiful, reciprocal, and redemptive interrelationship between our wound, our pain, our failure, and our destiny, and what God had, the work that God has for us to do. And it's certainly true of my autobiography or my story. And I think, you know, I grew up in this very staunch, like, evangelical model of discipleship. And, you know, evangelicalism comes out of a kind of enlightenment Cartesian worldview. It's very information based. And there's this kind of formula for what we would have called spiritual growth at the time, or like old school sanctification. And it's essentially, you know, again, it was not in the charismatic stream, which picks this up and then adds some things to it. But it was essentially come to church on Sunday and learn more about the Bible, read the Bible, study the Bible, listen to preaching on the Bible, have a morning quiet time, and then tithe or give. And small groups were not even like in our radar. So there wasn't even a call to like do life in a living room, wasn't even on the formula that I grew up with. And again, all of those practices are in my rule of life. I continue them today. I'm not down on them. It was just missing a more holistic, ancient, frankly, more biblical view of discipleship.
Yeah.
So I'm a product of that in that, you know, that model tends to take you so far in the spiritual journey, early in the spiritual journey. So, you know, the critical journey, people at Fuller Seminary, they break the spiritual journey, and this is all, you know, relative, none of this is capital T truth, but they identify six stages in the spiritual journey, and they argue based on their data that most American Christians never mature beyond stage three.
Right.
In fact, they would argue most pastors never mature beyond stage three. And certainly one of the reasons is that most churches don't offer a model of discipleship that goes beyond stage three, which is why a lot of people who actually, you see this weird disillusionment that comes, and I'm not talking about the like deconstructionist, I hate the church.
Right.
You see this weird disillusionment that actually comes from the godlier, like it's a lot quieter, but you see these people that are like active in their church, love Jesus, involved, are mature, and then like they reach a point of maturity and they just get profoundly bored.
Yeah.
And they start to even get a little bit like, what is this? And then where disillusionment often comes in is they feel they have to go outside of the church to a secular therapist or to mindfulness or to whatever in order to actually continue to grow to be more like Jesus, which is a great travesty. So there's something about, you know, Willard had that line, your system is perfectly designed to give you the results you are getting, which is actually a business line that he applied to formation. So I think my experience was early on in the spiritual journey, which in my case would have been through, you know, high school, college, early 20-somethings, I felt like there was a forward motion to my formation. And I was becoming, let's just take the fruit of the Spirit, more, a little bit more loving and joyful and peaceful and patient year over year. But then I kind of felt like I hit this plateau the moment my discipleship to Jesus began to touch on the deeper issues of my shadow side. So, you know, in my case, it would be stuff like chronic perfectionism that goes back generations in my family line, and that manifests as sarcastic, digging, critical, nagging. People close to me feel like they're never good enough, can never make me happy, it's nothing's ever done well enough. It manifests like due to a kind of traumatic experience I had as a little kid, not a familiar one, a physical, where I either died or almost died and was resuscitated, and the doctors I've worked with think it has permanently kind of broken my nervous system. So high anxiety, alarm system, constantly scanning the universe for threats and fight or flight, just at a physical, bodily level, even when my life with Jesus and community is really, really good. It would look like, you know, stuff like that. And challenges in my marriage, you know, my wife, who's doing 1,000 times better now, was chronically ill for 15 years. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, this formula was not working on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, evangelicalism is built on the assumption, coming out of an Enlightenment kind of Cartesian view of the human person as a brain on legs, the Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am,
right.
You know, that kind of view of the person, that as a person, the assumption is as a person's knowledge of the Bible increases, their spiritual maturity will increase along with it. And there's just enough truth in that myth early in the spiritual journey to keep people believing it. When people are brand new followers of Jesus, in particular as the gap between the cultural norm and the New Testament norm gets nothing but wider year over year on the right and on the left, in our country at least, there's going to be a high correlation, if you're a brand new follower of Jesus, between learning what Jesus says in the New Testament and your spiritual formation as you kind of reorient to the mental maps of Jesus and Scripture. But eventually, as you begin to reorient to these mental maps, the problems that you are then beginning to solve for are likely not going to be solved. You know, my broken nervous system and the way that my anxious personality can cause me to be controlling with my teenage kids, and out of fear, shame them into the behavior that I think is the right behavior for them. Yeah. Or my sarcastic contempt that will leak out toward my wife when I'm tired and I'm stressed because nothing is ever good enough for me and no one is ever good. An exegetical sermon series through Romans is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's probably not going to solve those problems.
Yeah,
I'm probably going to walk out and still shame my son if I get a bad grade, he gets a bad grade and I get freaked out and, you know. So it's not that discipleship doesn't work. It's that the model of discipleship that is ironically has a high view of the Bible and an unbiblical view of the human person,
yeah,
that doesn't work. So I kind of hit this plateau. And then, because I'm at the right to timestamp the age here, then somebody put a glowing rectangle in my pocket for the first time. Thank you, Steve Jobs. And we entered the digital age. And now I have this whole other gigantic challenge that wasn't even there in my life before of distraction and attention and addiction and busyness and hurry. And then as the pressures of pastoral life and personal life, just once you become a dad, we have three kids and we're leading a large church and preaching all of the time and adulting, we have a mortgage. At that point, I began to feel like I was not only no longer progressing, but I was regressing. Mm-hmm. So that's a very long way of saying all of that brought me to a breaking point where I was just like doing more Bible study, going to church more, trying harder, feeling bad about it, was not doing anything.
Right.
And so it was around then that I discovered the writings of Dallas Willard.
Yeah.
And around the same time, I was introduced to a phenomenal therapist who's the PhD, who was a Quaker pastor forever ago, and is just a 70-year-old sage. And with him as my kind of relational guide, and then through Willard, who was kind of my portal to the whole world of formation, I began learning and reading and experimenting. It just, it's like it opened up a whole new portal to a whole other ancient model of discipleship. And I wish I could say it fixed me and like I did these nine things and now I'm like J-pathic level, chill and holy and awesome.
We obviously don't know each other well enough,
It did not fix me, but I do feel unstuck,
you
know? I do feel a significant whole new layer of healing and freedom. And like I'm at least moving ever so slowly, three steps forward, two steps back, zigzag, all of that. Well, but I think that's how I came to the work.
Well, what's amazing to me hearing your that bit of your story is probably by all and any external accounts, life is going as well as it could go for anyone.
Well, that's the terrifying thing.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, the church is blowing up for all the, and the back from blowing up, man.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah,
I used to be a good term. Good.
It's doing well.
The church was,
And you're...
Well, doing well by mega church metrics.
Precisely, yeah.
But I actually noticed something that as, you know, the church grew really, really fast and really, really large, and at least by my standards. And, but I began to notice something right about when we hit maybe about, or pretty early actually, about 2,000 people, that the people that were the original core of our church, where we had this incredible community, began to slowly and quietly drift away.
Yeah.
And they weren't angry, they weren't yelling, they weren't screaming, because nothing terrible was happening. And what they said was, it's just too big.
Yeah.
And then the people that were then coming in droves, there were some great people in there, but there was a large amount of them that I never even met that were kind of coming because they wanted the anonymity.
Yeah.
And so things were going really well by certain metrics.
But you can feel something's out of place here, not just in me, but in the way that we're doing this.
There's something.
Right.
And because the church was full of people like me. Mm. It was full of people that had a lot of growth early in the spiritual journey,
right,
had hit a plateau, or even began to now like go in the wrong direction with age and form and suffering in the digital age. And they weren't bad people. There was a genuine love for Jesus and desire to grow and mature. It was the model of how are we spiritually formed?
Yeah.
That's what was broken, you know?
And just the idea that if we just keep re-racking everything, maybe we'll get a better result.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so then you start into some of these explorations personally. That, of course, then changes the way that you start to lead and what you're doing within the life of your church. Just say a little bit about how did you start to think about what the job of a pastor is differently, or what it means to be a church? How was that changing? I imagine it shows up in how you talk, but what were you doing to lead differently, you personally, and then what were you dreaming about? What were you trying to do in the life of your church?
Well, a mentor of mine you know, introduced me to the language that's very common in clinical psychology of a theory of change. And it's actually used a lot in nonprofit work. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your theory of change? Whether you're talking about a human soul that has a brokenness or addiction or pain, mm-hmm. or you're a nonprofit working with the houseless in Denver or whatever, right. what's your theory of change?
Right.
And I found that language really helpful because I realized I'd never really thought about it.
Right.
And I think that's where a lot of people are.
Yep.
They almost receive a theory of change.
And just run it. Right.
And yep. run it, but it's yep. often unconscious, totally. Not conscious, yep. which often means it's haphazard, not intentional, mm-hmm. and may mean that it's incredibly ineffective
right.
rather than transformative. And so we spent a long time, one, trying to identify what was our theory of change. And again, coming out of that evangelical Bible church world, mm-hmm. we articulated it, and no pastor would have ever said this because this doesn't line up with good, you know, theology. But it was basically information plus inspiration plus willpower equals change.
Mm-hmm.
And so information, meaning learning the Bible, learning theology, learning Christian yep. truth through preaching, teaching,
getting
reading.
Excited yep. about it. Right,
and
right.
inspiration.
Right, right.
You know, and by then we're moving into the charismatic stream.
Right, totally.
So, you know, charismatics would say, no, you need experience. And there is that like romantic stream also yeah. in Western culture mm-hmm. of like, you got to feel it. And if it's not right. true to who yeah. you are, it's the longest journey a thumb thing ever has to make is from the head to the heart. Just absolutely nonsense. But, you know, whatever. You know, it's got to get into the heart. We got to right. feel it. It's got to be yeah. romantic. We got to, you know, we got to yeah. touch the heart with our life and our right. preaching. People got to yeah. encounter God. Yeah. And then at the end of the day, it was like, so then go do it.
Right.
And so nobody would have ever said, so now it's on your willpower. Every, right. In fact, everybody would have hated that language, right. would have said, no, it's by the grace of God. It's by the Spirit yeah, of God. Yeah, you yeah. can only do this in the power of the Spirit. Right. But it never moved beyond cliche mm-hmm. to like, how?
Yeah, what's the doing exactly?
Yeah, in like old yeah. school theological language, how do I appropriate grace? I know that grace is mine theologically,
right.
but how do I appropriate it? How do I draw on it? Because I want to rely on the Spirit, but at the end of the day, I don't know how. And so then right. I'm just trying really hard
yeah.
to take what I learned Sunday and had an emotional desire right. moment with Sunday and yeah. go do it, you know? Yeah. So we spent several years meeting with reading all sorts of crazy stuff, Christian and non-Christian and mm-hmm. neuroscience and mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. And we came up with our kind of working theory of change, and which we had, and then we held up our working theory of change against our model of church.
Mm.
And we realized,
we're not programmed the right way or
yes,
doing things, right?
Our yeah. church is not designed
right.
to produce a high level of transformation in a large number of people.
Yeah.
And it's designed for other good things, you know, bad, not bad things,
right.
but not for that.
Yep.
And so there were two pieces that were core to our theory of change that we were doing well. One was mm-hmm. teaching, and the other was like encounter with the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. By that time, we'd been like utterly transformed by a mm-hmm. Journey into the things of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. So we were like teaching well. There was a really incredible culture of teaching, not just on Sundays. And there was a real sense of the Spirit. Mm. But the two kind of huge missing pieces that are a little bit more programmatic, there's other things that you don't program, like suffering, that's absolutely right. crucial to yeah. formation.
Need not
Our program. Church doesn't have like a plan, like, all right, so we're doing one suffering per quarter this year. So sign up for the suffering
It'll
class,
come, have no fear.
And we're right. gonna, you know, no. Right. But it was practice and community.
Mm.
And we realized community doesn't happen even in a church of 150 people.
Right.
That's still, you're still at a kind of village level. Yeah. You're not at a soul level.
Yeah.
And practice was like the wildly missing piece. Mm. And in the digital age where digital distraction, hurry, chronic exhaustion, where burnout's a rite of passage for millennials, practice is arguably more important than it's ever been, because
yeah.
a lot of the practices that have been lost used to be more just in the cultural architecture.
Yeah.
So you didn't need to hear and read 19 books on Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, you know, even growing up in what we now call Silicon Valley, on Sunday, nothing was open.
They closed the stores.
I mean, right. he told me, like, right. he remembers when 7-Eleven yeah. came, and it was the first time you could buy something on a Sunday, and it was, like, radical right. and so, controversial.
Right.
Everything shut down in what we now call Silicon Valley. And he said everybody went to church. You were either Protestant,
right.
Catholic, or if you weren't a Christian, like he right. was, you went to a mainline church.
Right.
And he was like, but everybody still went to church, and then most people yeah. all had family dinner afterwards. Mm-hmm. I mean, just that world is gone. Now that's a, you know, mostly middle class kind of whatever. Probably would have been majority white at the time. But still, that world is gone, you know? So the church could assume this cultural architecture and then kind of preach the Bible into it. We can no longer assume that cultural architecture.
Yeah.
And so these were kind of the missing pieces that we realized, man, we have to actually like, kind of, we don't have to blow up our church, but we have to do a pretty significant, it's not a like raise it and build something else, but it is like a pretty significant re-architecture of the bone, you know, the a pretty significant change.
Yeah, and I assume, I mean, everything you're saying, most humans would hear and go, that sounds great.
Yeah.
But then when it gets to the doing, that means my schedule has to change.
Yes, our metrics for success had to change.
Right. So, and I'm sure everyone just heard you say it one time and agreed.
Yes. Well, you're trying to change the social contract.
Right.
So every church is built off of often an unconscious but implicit social contract.
Yeah.
And ours was built off of, we'll come on Sunday and you teach us really well and create space for us to encounter God and we'll be there and help make it happen. And now we're changing the social contract of we want you to do life around a table. We want you to bear your soul in vulnerability and confession. We want you to go below the line and explore the deep stuff. We want you to organize your life around practices that slow you down.
Yeah.
We want you to simplify your life and we want you to do it all together. You know, we're changing the social contract.
Yeah.
So I think by then I'd learned some regrets. We'd done one other kind of major change initiative before, many years before in the kind of missional era of church, the church movement. And I'd done everything wrong of just trying to kind of railroad in a new vision based on righteous zeal. And I'd learned the hard way that just wounds people and doesn't tend to produce the change you want. Mm. So I think we'd learned a lot about how community change, that we were able to not do perfectly, but bring some of those failures around another time. And we went really slow. And so that's where, you know, we took our church on a very intentional 5-year long journey. You know, depending on when you timestamp it, you could say 7-year long journey before the end of my tenure there. That was very slow and very gradual and very intentional and very thoughtful for all of the mistakes we made along the way.
Right.
We did not hurry it and we made it as invitational as possible. I'd learned the hard way that you cannot, you know, as one of our staff members used to say, coercion is not a fruit of the spirit. That, you know, that it's like parenting teenagers. You often know what they need to do.
Right.
But if you make them do what they need to do, it blows up in your face, you know? And so there's some kind of parallel there at a pastoral level. So but still, even with this change being gradual and slow and thoughtful and intentional and invitational, still, our church shrunk, and there was just a season, and then it was like pruning, and then eventually grew, and we had the healthiest season we've ever had in the life of our church. But man, that season of like following your convictions, the church shrinking, I remember one Sunday, I have this distinctive memory of walking up to preach, and there was like nobody there in a place that used to be packed out. Not nobody, but it was like...
Comparatively, right.
And it was embarrassing. Right. It was bad. And I just thought, what have we done?
Yeah.
But I think we got to the spot. I mean, you get to a spot, that high of the church is growing and we planted a church, we're the cool, that high goes away really quickly.
Yeah.
It's replaced by exhaustion.
Yeah.
And then you're like, in my case, not very old. I'm like, I'm not going to just run this machine till I'm retirement age.
Yeah.
So I'm either going to go do something else with my life or we got to do something that is more in line with our convictions. So we were okay with failure. We didn't want it to fail and it didn't. But we had made peace with, and that anytime you try to lead an experiment or change, you don't know how it's going to go. Because it's not just up to you. Even if you do everything perfectly right, that's the role of a community comes in. And so that's the real gift of the core of our community was extraordinary. And they went on the journey and were beautiful souls along the way. And they are really what made it possible for us to have such a beautiful run and slowly build a new model of church and culture.
Well, and we've talked, I've heard bits of this, But it's interesting hearing it more comprehensively, like it really helps make sense of what's in your heart now. I mean, I like listening to you now.
Yeah.
What you're writing, how you're trying to serve the church. You're an actual pastor. You've pastored people. You've been in church. So
yeah.
Yeah, that connects a lot of dots for me. I really appreciate you sharing your story.
This summer, Vineyard USA is hosting our national conference, Seed and Soil, in two locations, Denver, Colorado on June 17th through 20th and Cincinnati, Ohio on July 15th through 18th. We hope that by offering two locations and dates, everyone, pastors, leaders, volunteers, even those just curious about the Vineyard, everyone will be able to find a time to join us. The conference will have specific programming for adults, youth, and kids, while we focus on cultivating healthy soil in our hearts and planting seeds for the future for all that God wants to do in us and in the Vineyard. Registration is now open with early bird pricing, so make sure to check out vineyarduSA.org to learn more and register today.